I may, Your Honor?
Surely.
My name is Mark Ginnon, and together with my daughter, Emily Ginnon Hodson, we represent the plaintiffs and the appellants in this case. The status of this case is an appeal from the district court order following a dismissal of a 7-count complaint. That dismissal was with prejudice and without opportunity to amend. The complaint had originally been filed in the Indiana State Court.
Just a minute. That is the first thing that I was wondering about, because you've argued that it was improper for the district court to apply the heightened federal pleading requirements because of it. You shouldn't be expected to foresee removal to federal court. My question would be, couldn't you have simply sought to amend your complaint once it was removed? But you're saying there was no opportunity to amend?
No, Your Honor, after the dismissal was with prejudice, okay, and as it was with prejudice, there were 5 counts that were dismissed on the basis of standing, and there were 2 counts on the basis of that were dismissed on the basis of failure to state a claim. What we were concerned about, we had a petition to remand that was also on file at that time, and we were concerned that if we filed to amend at that point, that we would be accepting or perhaps waiving our argument that this matter should, in fact, be heard in the state court. So we did not affirmatively seek an amendment at that time, but we were notified on the issue of the standing.
So, in other words, it was a tiny little bit of a misstatement to say you didn't have an opportunity to amend, because, of course, you did.
The court did not issue as part of its order a right to amend, which is oftentimes the case.
It's your right.
Understood.
Courts don't have to say to you, you know, you can do this, you can do that. In fact, we're not permitted to do that, because then we'd have to take part of your fee.
Your Honor, we'd also point out on a procedural matter that the Hylent Group Incorporated issues that were on appeal have been settled while this appeal was pending. Your Honor, if we look at this case, there are parties to an insurance contract, GNS Holdings, GNS Tradings, and Aluminum Sizing Incorporated, as well as Scott and Cindy Galley. The three corporations were, in fact, parties to the insurance contract. Scott and Cindy Galley are the owners, the managers, and the officers of the corporations. All of these companies were in the business of secondary aluminum processing. The business's principal location was in Wabash, Indiana, and business was good. They decided then to expand their business to Manchester, Georgia. A second plant was built in Manchester, Georgia, for the purpose of expanding the business. Approximately $7 million was used for that purpose. The expansion was completed in November of 2007, and within weeks thereafter, on November the 29th of 2007, this explosion occurred.
Let me just sort of get to the heart of, is your claim based on a violation of a duty owed to you as a named insured, or is it based on the violation of a duty owed to GSMC that then caused damage to you?
Both, Your Honor.
Well, both?
Yes.
If it's the latter, how is your status as a named insured relevant to the standing issue, given that you're not claiming any duty to you as the named insured was violated?
Your Honor, what we looked to is that as a result of this explosion, and then as a result of Continental's failure to pay in full and in a timely fashion, there were additional damages that flowed. What our position is that Continental was well aware of the concerted business activities that these companies were involved in together, because they were on notice at the time that the contract was entered into for insurance coverage.
But you're not alleging that Continental violated any duty owed to them under the policy, are you?
No, Your Honor. At this point, what we are looking to is that, one, they were on notice that we had a claim, and they were on notice that we were named insured under this policy. and that we would have rights that would, in fact, be protected as a result of that policy. However, where we are, where we look at this is that there was an insurable interest that was shared by these parties, and that the contract was entered into at a time where they were certainly, Continental was certainly aware of the interdependence of these companies.
But you see, GSMC's financial difficulties that were caused by, any alleged violation of the policy might in turn have caused hardship to, others who were owed money by GSMC, but that doesn't give them a right to sue Continental directly, does it?
We believe it does in this case, Your Honor, simply because Continental was on specific notice that these named insureds were an interdependent part of their business operation, that there was no one laying in the bushes. It was laid out on the table that these companies were interconnected and were all named as insurance policy.
Well, tell me why I would be wrong if I thought the following. If I thought that GSMC has brought a direct suit against Continental, and therefore that the plaintiffs in this case can in turn sue GSMC for any amounts owed them by it, but they can't directly sue Continental under that theory. Why would I be wrong?
I believe any remote creditor would have the right to go directly against GSMC. The fact is, in this case, because these entities were so closely related in their management, their officers, and in their conduct of their business, that they had the foresight to, in fact, insure with Continental for losses that might be sustained. And as a result of that foresight, they, in fact, did have themselves named as a policyholder under this insurance policy with Continental. And I believe that's what's distinctive here in this case. Now, Your Honor, what we look to in all of this is that we do not believe that the court should apply the federal requirements or the heightened requirements of the federal statute as opposed to the pleading requirements of Indiana's statute.
Can I ask you an answer question?
Sure.
Did your clients here, the five plaintiffs, file a claim with the insurance company that was denied?
They put on notice the insurance company. We believe that there was not a request made by the insurance company asking under the provisions of the policy for a claim to be filed. So they were never put on notice that they had to file a claim. But they did put the company on notice, or the insurance company was aware of the loss that was sustained by these entities as well as by GSMC.
So the insurance company has to pay these five entities even though a claim is not submitted?
If they don't ask for one, then you don't have to comply with part of the policy.
Well, then how does the insurance company know how much to pay if there's no claim submitted?
I believe, Your Honor, that they were on notice basically as a result of the claim that was submitted by GSMC and the failure to pay that, that they certainly were aware that consequential damages would be sustained.
So who gets the money, GSMC or the five plaintiffs in this case?
I believe both. The GSMC, the experts that would be retained in this to determine the damages would, in fact, have the ability to determine what portion of the damages should go to GSMC and what portion should be set off to the five plaintiffs.
Oh, so you think that there's one recovery. There can't be a double recovery. There's only one recovery, and it has to be allocated between GSMC and the five plaintiffs here.
I think it has to be distinguished so that there's not a duplication in recovery. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So why couldn't the five plaintiffs here have intervened in the GSMC case just so you had a single pot?
Attempted and denied, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if I may say rebuttal for my daughter. Please.
Attempted and denied in which court?
In the same court. Same judge, Your Honor, in the GSMC case, which is proceeding parallel with this one.
In front of Judge?
DiGiulio.
DiGiulio. Okay. In other words, that didn't happen in state court. Nothing happened.
No. State court was removed immediately, Your Honor.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Hinkhouse. Hello.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joe Hinkhouse, and I represent Continental Casualty Company in this case. I think it's important to point out the nature of the insurance policy that we're dealing with. It's a commercial property loss policy, and it responds to direct physical loss to covered property. And as counsel mentioned, there was direct physical loss to covered property, which was this explosion and fire in November of 2007. But I think what's the problem for the plaintiff's case is that the property that was damaged, the equipment, the building, wasn't owned by any of these plaintiffs. It was owned by GSMC, which made their own claim.
Why then are they on the policy?
I'm sorry?
Why are they on the policy then?
Three of these plaintiffs are on the policy, two are not. But the ones that are on the policy would be, of course, if they sustain their own loss. My client had bilateral rights to each one of them. If in this explosion, for example, one of these companies had some equipment in the building, or they had their own explosion in their building, or had some direct physical loss to covered property, certainly they could bring a claim. But that's not what happened here. The only party that suffered damage or loss is GSMC, which made its own independent claim.
But doesn't the inclusion of the plaintiffs as named insureds on the policy indicate that they have an interest in ensuring that the claims are paid? In other words, why wouldn't they have standing to sue to protect that interest?
I think that issue is covered in the Vectren case. Some policies have hundreds of named insureds. For example, a construction policy, you've got the general contractor and all of the subs. It's the party that sustains the loss that has the right to bring the claim. In this case, it would be the party that sustains the direct physical loss to covered property. And
well, then what type of suits would they be able to bring, based on their status as named insureds?
I think under a property damage policy, they would bring a claim for loss to their own property. If they had, for example, some personal property in this building that exploded, they could come in and make a claim for that property, which they didn't do because they didn't have a loss of property. And in answer to Your Honor's question earlier about whether these claimants made a claim, the answer is no. They admit, I think it's very interesting and I think dispositive, in their complaint, they allege that Continental Casualty insured GNS Metals Consultants, Inc., GSMC, for the losses from the explosion. So they're even alleging that it's not them that have the rights under the policy. It's GSMC. And they go further in their brief in the trial court. On page 5, they specifically say, in this case, the damages sustained by plaintiffs did not occur due to the explosion at the Georgia plant. So they're saying we don't have a claim due to this explosion. They say instead the damages incurred as a result of CCC, Continental Casualty, failing to timely and fully pay the claim owed to GNS Metals Consultants, Inc. So it's exactly what this business about that they didn't make a claim because we didn't ask them to, or they didn't submit a claim for whatever reason. The fact is, even in their complaint, they say their case isn't about these plaintiffs having a claim. The crux of their case is that they lost some sort of downstream economic benefit or economic benefit from contracts that they had with GSMC. And I think under the case law, that sort of incidental downstream commercial activity isn't covered. It doesn't make them a third-party beneficiary. It doesn't give them any rights under the insurance policy. The only folks who can recover under this insurance policy are people who sustain the direct loss to physical property. The other issue, I think, on the pleading was addressed by the court and by counsel. The pleading issue about whether it's the state standard or the federal standard, I think, was waived. In their brief and underneath below, pages 1 and 2, they invoke the federal standard. They cite two federal cases, and they basically say they meet the standard. So they weren't arguing that somehow they should have a right or that they should be given an opportunity to amend. They invoked and embraced the federal standard and couldn't meet it. And I think, of course, more fundamentally, it's not really that they didn't have an opportunity to fully articulate or allege their case. I think the problem was that what they did say showed that they didn't have a cause of action, showed that they had no standing. And I think when you look at the case law, I think the trial court's ruling can be affirmed on three separate and distinct and independent grounds. One is standing, which the trial court focused on for most of the causes of action, and a sort of prudential limitations on standing. These folks just simply don't own or don't have a right to these causes of action.
If we agree with you on standing, doesn't that mean that we have to make the dismissal of those counts without prejudice as opposed to with prejudice?
No, I think that would be the case if it was under constitutional standing requirements. I think under the prudential limitations, when it's clear, as it is in this case, that these parties don't own this cause of action and the claims are otherwise dismissed under Rule 12b-6, I think the case was properly dismissed with prejudice.
What were those five counts dismissed under 12b-1 or 12b-6?
It was 12b-6 and standing and Rule 17a, real party in interest. So I think under any of those grounds, I think the dismissal with prejudice was appropriate.
Well, I'm wondering, which one did the district judge choose?
I'm sorry? 12b,
which ground did the district judge choose for those five claims? 12b-1, 12b-6, or Rule 17, or some combination?
For the five that he found no standing, it was argued under 12b-6. I think it was also under the standing principles, prudential standing limitations, and it was under Rule 17a, real party in interest. It was found that those parties simply don't have a right to those causes of action. For example, two of the claims were two of the allegations were for claims handling, negligent.
On what ground did you argue for dismissal of the district court?
We argued all of the above. We argued.
You argued all of them?
We argued all of them, yes.
My problem with the standing Rule 17 one is that take on the face of the complaint, they are alleging an injury. They're alleging that they have, in fact, and as they've said here today, an insurable interest in the insurance contract, and that you have an obligation to pay them on the basis that they've set forth. Sounds like a real controversy.
Well, they alleged...
It may not be a meritorious one, but it sounds like a real controversy.
They've alleged that they were financially damaged by our breach of contract, not to them, but to GSMC.
That's right.
And so I think in terms of the constitutional standing requirements, that they've suffered some sort of cognizable injury, I think they do meet those. They don't meet the plethora of case law that talks about prudential limitations on standing, which is, do they really own the cause of action? Do they really have a right to bring a breach of contract claim when they say in their complaint that they're not seeking any damages under the contract? They specifically allege that GSMC, this third party, was insured under the policy for this explosion, and we breached the contract as to the third party. So while they've suffered some damage, I think the trial court was correct to say you may have suffered some downstream commercial loss because of this, but you don't have a right
under
the
contract. The face of the complaint, there is no cognizable injury. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. Paragraph 13. They talk about damage to GSMC and that we breached the contract to GSMC and not to them. And I think they pled themselves out of court with that allegation. See, my red light is on, and unless Your Honors have any other questions.
Thank you. Gannon Hudson.
As I begin, I would like to clarify one of the questions that was previously asked. The five counts of the complaint that the court dismissed regarding standing, that was on 12b-1. Defendants did argue it based on several issues, but 12b-1 was what the court ultimately decided that issue on. One thing that I guess I want to impress upon the court is that what we're dealing with here, while it is an insurance policy, it is also a contract. And the plaintiffs in this case are parties to that contract. This is a contract that was created by Continental. Now, Continental has advanced the position today that there were bilateral rights given to each of these parties. This is the first time that I've heard the term bilateral rights used in the context of dealing with this contract. Because as we're looking at the contract, and I think an acceptable and appropriate interpretation of this contract, which does involve the plaintiffs in this case, as well as GSMC and Continental, is that this is one contract which Continental created. It was a contract intended to protect the interests of all of the parties to that contract, some of those parties being the plaintiffs that are here today. They had an interest in that contract. Continental could have easily set up multiple contracts between each individual named insured and Continental itself. We could have had five separate contracts in the situation.
But how do we deal with the fact that you never alleged that Continental violated any duty owed to the named insureds under the policy?
We did
leap over that.
We did allege that in our complaint, but I believe that the duties that we're dealing with here are slightly different. There is a duty under the policy to pay the claim that GSMC filed. We recognize that. What our position is, though, is that not only did Continental have a duty to GSMC to pay the claim that GSMC filed, but Continental had a duty to the other parties to the contract, the plaintiffs in this case, to abide by the terms of that contract.
Under your view of the law, how far out would we have to go?
You would only have to go to as far as the parties to the contract. You wouldn't have to go beyond the scope of the parties to the contract. In this case, the plaintiffs are parties to the contract. And because they're parties to the contract, they had certain expectations that the terms of the contract would be satisfied and would be fulfilled by Continental. Continental breached that contract. When Continental breached the contract of which the plaintiffs are parties, they harmed the plaintiffs.
How did Continental breach the contract? Other than by not paying GSMC's claim?
That is the way that the Continental did breach the contract. They did not timely and reasonably pay, in a reasonable fashion, the claim advanced by GSMC. Had Continental abided by the terms of the contract and done what they promised to do under those terms of the contract, then the other parties to the contract would not have been harmed because those payments would have been made in a timely fashion. And we as the plaintiffs, we as the parties to the contract, have an expectation and a right to assume that the terms of the contract are going to be satisfied. And in this case, they simply were not. And that's what gives us standing, whereas parties that are more distant or that are not parties to the contract perhaps and likely would not have standing in this situation. See, my red light is on, but if there are any other questions.
Do you want to add anything? Because I think we gave a little more time. It's pure. Friend over there.
Your Honor, it would probably wrap me into a bunch of additional time, so I'll stop at that point unless there are questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to all. Case will be taken under advisement.